Chapter 36. Before I leave, Mr. Sirola says I should return next day to observe Miss Mudd with her 5 classes. I'd learned something about procedure. He says half of teaching is procedure, and I don't know what he's talking about. I don't know what to make of the smile through the cigarette smoke, and I wonder if he's joking. He pushes my typed program across the desk. 3 classes of EC, Economic Citizenship, 2 classes of E4, Sophomore English, in the 4th term. The top of the program card says, Official Class, PRA, and at the bottom, Building Assignment, School Cafeteria, Period 5. I don't ask Mr. Sirola what these mean for fear he might think I'm ignorant and change his mind about hiring me. As I make my way down the hill to the ferry, a boy's voice calls, Mr. McCourt, Mr. McCourt, are you Mr. McCourt? I am. Mr. Sirola would like to see you again. I follow the student up the hill, and I know why Mr. Sirola wants to see me again. He has changed his mind. He's found someone with experience, someone with a grasp of procedure, someone who knows what an official class is. If I don't get this job, I'll have to start my search again. Mr. Sirola waits at the front door of the school. He lets his cigarette dangle from his mouth and puts his hand on my shoulder. He says, I have good news for you. The job is opening sooner than we expected. Miss Mudd must have been impressed by you because she decided to leave today. In fact, she's gone, out the back door, and it's barely noon. So we're wondering if you can take over tomorrow, and then you won't have to wait till Monday. Yeah, I know, you're not ready. That's okay. We'll give you some stuff to keep the kids busy till you get the hang of it. And I look in from time to time to keep them in line. He tells me this is my golden opportunity to jump right in and start my teaching career. I'm young. I like the kids. They're like me. McKee High School has a hell of a faculty, all ready to help and support. Of course I say yes. I'll be in tomorrow. It isn't the teaching job of my dreams, but it'll have to do, since I can't get anything else. I sit on the Staten Island ferry thinking of teacher recruiters from suburban high schools at NYU. How they told me I seemed intelligent and enthusiastic, but really, my accent would be a problem. Oh, they had to admit it was charming, reminded them of that nice Barry Fitzgerald and Going My Way, but. They say they had high standards of speech in their schools, and it wouldn't be possible to make an exception in my case, since the brogue was infectious. And what would parents say if their kids came home sounding like Barry Fitzgerald or Maureen O'Hara? I wanted to work in one of their suburban schools, Long Island, Westchester, where the boys and girls were bright, cheerful, smiling, attentive, their pens poised as I discoursed on Beowulf, the Canterbury Tales, the Cavalier Poets, the Metaphysicals. I'd be admired, and once the boys and girls had passed my classes, their parents would surely invite me to dinner at their finest houses. Young mothers would come to see me about their children, and who could tell what might happen when husbands were absent, the men in grey flannel suits, and I trolled the suburbs for lonely wives. I'd have to forget the suburbs. I have here on my lap the book that will help me through my first day of teaching, Your World and You, and I flip the pages through a short history of the United States from an economic point of view, chapters on American government, the banking system, how to read the stock market pages, how to open a savings account, how to keep household accounts, how to get loans and mortgages. At the end of each chapter, there are questions of fact and questions for discussion. What caused the stock market crash of 1929? How can this be avoided in the future? If you wanted to save money and gain interest, would you A, keep it in a glass jar, B, invest it in the Japanese stock market, C, keep it under your mattress, D, put it in a savings bank account? There are suggested activities with insertions penciled in by a former student. Call a family meeting and discuss your family finances with Dad and Mom. Show them from your study of this book how they might improve their bookkeeping. Insertion. Don't be surprised if they beat you up. Take a tour of the New York Stock Exchange with your class. They'll be glad to get out of school for a day. Think of a product your community might need and start a small company to supply it. Try Spanish Fly. Write to the Federal Reserve Board and tell them what you think of them. Tell them leave a little for the rest of us. Interview a number of people who remember the crash of 1929 and write a 1,000-word report. Ask them why they didn't commit suicide. Write a story in which you explain the gold standard to a 10-year-old child. It'll help him sleep. Write a report on what it cost to build the Brooklyn Bridge and what it might cost now. Be specific, or else. The ferry sails by Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty, and I'm so worried about economic citizenship, I don't even think of the millions who landed here, and the ones who were sent back with the bad eyes and the weak chests. I don't know how I'll be able to stand before these American teenagers and talk to them about the branches of government and preach the virtues of saving when I owe money everywhere myself. And with the ferry sliding into its slip and the day that's facing me tomorrow, why shouldn't I treat myself to a few beers at the Beanpot Bar? And after those few beers, why shouldn't I take a train to the White Horse Bar in Greenwich Village to chat with Paddy and Tom Clancy and listen to them sing in the back room? When I call Mike to tell her the good news about the new job, she wants to know where I am, gives me a lecture on the stupidity of staying out drinking beer the night before the most important day of my life, and I'd better get my ass home if I know what's good for me. Sometimes she talks like her grandmother, who always tells you what to do with your ass. Get your ass in here, get your ass out of that bed. Mike is right, but she graduated from high school, and she'll know what to say to her classes when she starts teaching. And even though I have a college degree, I don't know what I'm going to say to Miss Mudd's classes. Should I be Robert Donut in Goodbye, Mr. Chips, or Glenn Ford in The Blackboard Jungle? Should I swagger into the classroom like James Cagney, or march in like an Irish schoolmaster with a stick, a strap, and a roar? If a student sends a paper airplane zooming at me, should I shove my face into his and tell him, try that one more time, kid, and you're in trouble? What am I to do with the ones looking out the window and calling to their friends across the yard? If they're like some of the students in the Blackboard Jungle, they'll be tough and they'll ignore me, and the rest of the class will despise me. Paddy Clancy leaves his singing in the back room of the White Horse and tells me he wouldn't be in my shoes for anything. Everyone knows what the high schools in this country are like. That's right, Blackboard Jungles. With my college degree, why didn't I become a lawyer or a businessman or something where I could make some money? He knows a few teachers around the village, and they're getting out of it the first opportunity. He's right, too. Everybody is right. And I'm too muddled with all the beer in my body to worry anymore. I go to my apartment and fall into bed with all my clothes on, and even though I'm worn out with the long day and the beer, I can't sleep. I keep getting up to read chapters of Your World and You, testing myself with questions of fact, imagining what I'm going to say about the stock market, the differences between stocks and bonds, the three branches of government, the recession of this year, the depression of that year, and I might as well get up, go out and fill myself with coffee to keep me going the rest of the day. At dawn, I sit in a coffee shop on Hudson Street with longshoremen, truck drivers, warehousemen, checkers. Why shouldn't I live like them? They work their 8 hours a day, read the daily news, follow baseball, have a few beers, go home to their wives, raise their kids. They're paid better than teachers, and they don't have to worry about Your World and You and sex-crazed teenagers who don't want to be in your class. In 20 years, working men can retire and sit in the Florida sun, waiting for lunch and dinner. I could call McKee Vocational High School and tell them, forget it, I want an easier life. I could tell Mr. Cirola they're looking for a checker at the Baker and Williams warehouse, a job I could easily get with my college degree, And all I'd have to do the rest of my life is stand on the platform with manifests and a clipboard, checking what comes and what goes. Then I think of what Mike Small would say if I told her, no, I didn't go to McKee High School today. I took a job as checker with Baker and Williams. She'd have a tantrum. She'd say, all that work in college to be a goddamn checker down at the docks. She might throw me out of the house and return to the arms of Bob, the football player, and I'd be alone in the world, forced to go to Irish dances and take home girls reserving their bodies for the wedding night. I'm ashamed of myself that I'm going to my first day of teaching in this condition, hungover from the White Horse Tavern, jumping out of my skin from 7 cups of coffee this morning, my eyes like 2 piss holes in the snow, 2 days of black hair sprouting on my face, my tongue furry from lack of a toothbrush, my heart banging in my chest from fatigue and fear of dozens of American adolescents. I'm sorry I ever left Limerick. I could be there with a pinch-double job in the post office, postman respected by one and all, married to a nice girl named Maura, raising 2 children, confessing my sins every Saturday, in a state of grace every Sunday, a pillar of the community, a credit to my mother, dying in the bosom of Mother Church, mourned by a large circle of friends and relations. There's a longshoreman at a table in the diner, telling his friend how his son is graduating from St. John's University in June, how he worked his ass off all these years to send the kid to college, and he's the luckiest man in the world because his son appreciates what he's doing for him. Graduation day, he gave himself a pat on the back for surviving a war and sending a son to college, a son who wants to be a teacher. His mother is so proud of him because she always wanted to be a teacher herself, but never had the chance, and this is the next best thing. Graduation day, they'll be the proudest parents in the world, and that's what it's all about, right? If this longshoreman and Horace down at Port Warehouses knew what I was thinking, they'd have no patience with me. They'd tell me how lucky I am to have a college degree and a chance to teach. The school secretary tells me see Miss Seasted, who tells me see Mr. Sorolla, who tells me see the chairman of the academic department, who says I have to check in with the school secretary to get my time card, and why were they sending me to him in the first place? The school secretary says, oh, back already, and shows me how to dip my time card into the time clock, how to place it in my slot on the inside, and how to move it to the outside. She says that if I have to leave the building for any reason whatsoever, even during my lunch period, I'm to sign out and back in with her, because you never know when you might be needed, never know when there might be an emergency, and you can't have teachers wandering in and out back and forth at will. She tells me see Miss Seasted, who looks surprised. Oh, you're back, she says, and gives me a red Delaney book, the attendance book for my classes. She says, of course you know how to use this, and I pretend I do for fear of being thought stupid. She sends me back to the school secretary for my homeroom attendance book, and I have to lie to the secretary too and tell her I know how to use it. She says, if I have any problems, ask the kids. They know more than the teachers. I'm trembling from the hangover and the coffee and the fear of what lies ahead of me. 5 classes, a homeroom, a building assignment. And I wish I were on the ferry to Manhattan where I could sit at a desk in a bank and make decisions about loans. Students jostle me in the hallway. They push and scuffle and laugh. Don't they know I'm a teacher? Can't they see under my arm 2 attendance books and Your World and You? The schoolmasters in Limerick would never tolerate this carry-on. They'd march up and down the halls with sticks, and if you didn't walk properly, you'd get that stick across the backs of your legs, so you would. And what am I supposed to do with this class, the first of my whole teaching career? Students of economic citizenship, pelting each other with chalk, erasers, bologna sandwiches. When I walk in and place my books on the teacher's desk, they'll surely stop throwing things, but they don't. They ignore me, and I don't know what to do till the words come out of my mouth. The first words I ever utter as a teacher, stop throwing sandwiches. They look at me as if to say, "Who's this guy?" The bell signals the start of the class, and the students slide into their seats. They whisper to each other. They look at me, laugh, whisper again. And I'm sorry I ever set foot on Staten Island. They turn to look at the blackboard along the side of the room where someone has printed in a large scrawl, "Miss Mudd is gone. They all bag retired." And when they see me looking at it, they whisper and laugh again. I open my copy of Your World and You as if to start a lesson, till a girl raises her hand. "Yes?"
"Teacher, ain't you going to take the attendance?"
"Oh, yes, I am."
"That's my job, teacher."
When she sways up the aisle to my desk, the boys make woo-woo sounds. "And what are you doing the rest of my life, Daniela?" She comes behind my desk, faces the class, and when she leans over to open the Delaney book, it's easy to see her blouse is too small, and that starts the woo-woo all over again. She smiles because she knows what the psychology books told us at NYU, that a 15-year-old girl is years ahead of a boy that age, and if they want to shower her with woo-woos, it means nothing. She whispers to me she's already going out with a senior, a football player up at Curtis High School, where all the kids are smart, not a bunch of auto mechanic grease monkeys like the ones in this class. The boys know this too, and that's why they pretend to clutch their hearts and faint when she calls out their names from the Delaney cards. She takes her time with the attendance book, and I'm a fool standing off to one side, waiting. I know she's teasing the boys, and I wonder if she's toying with me too, showing her control of the class with a well-filled blouse and keeping me from whatever I might want to do with economic citizenship. When she calls the name of someone who was absent yesterday, she demands a parent's note, and if the absentee doesn't have it, she reprimands him and writes N on the card. She reminds the class that 5 N's could get you an F on your report card and turns to me. "Isn't that right, teacher?" I don't know what to say. I nod. I blush. Another girl calls out, "Hey, teach, you cute." And I blush harder than ever. The boys roar and slap the desk with their open palms, and the girls smile at each other. They say, "You crazy, Yvonne," to the one who called me cute. And she tells them, "But he is, he's really cute." And I wonder if the redness will ever leave my face, if I'll ever be able to stand here and talk about economic citizenship, if I'll be forever at the mercy of Daniela and Yvonne. Daniela says she's finished with the attendance, and now she needs the pass to go to the bathroom. She takes a piece of wood from a drawer and wiggles her way out the door to another woo-woo chorus, and one boy calling to another, "Joy, stand up, Joy. Let's see how much you love her. Let's see you stand, Joy." And Joy blushes so hard there's a wave of laughter and giggling across the room. We're halfway through the period, and I haven't said a word about economic citizenship. I try to be a teacher, a schoolmaster. I pick up Your World and You and tell them, "Okay, open your book to chapter, what chapter were you up to?" "We weren't up to no chapter." "You mean you weren't up to any chapter, any chapter?" "No, I mean we weren't up to no chapter. Miss Mudd didn't teach us nothing." "Miss Mudd didn't teach you anything, anything." "Hey, teacher, why are you repeating everything I'm saying?" "Nothing, anything. Miss Mudd never bothered us like that. Miss Mudd was nice." They nod and murmur, "Yeah, Miss Mudd was nice." And I feel I have to compete with her even if they drove her into retirement. A hand is up. "Yes?"
"Teacher, you Scotch or something?"
"No, Irish."
"Oh, yeah? Irish like to drink, eh? All that whiskey, eh? You gonna be here Paddy's Day?"
"I'll be here on St. Patrick's Day."
"You're not gonna be drunk and thrown up at the parade like all the Irish?"
"I said I'll be here." "All right, open your books." A hand.
"What books, teacher?"
"This book, Your World and You."
"We ain't got that book, teacher."
"We don't have that book."
"There you go again, repeating everything we say."
"We have to speak proper English."
Teacher, this ain't no English class. This is economic citizenship. We supposed to be learning about money and all, and you ain't teaching us about money.
Daniela returns just as another hand is raised.
Teacher, what's your name?
Daniela returns the pass to the desk and tells the class,
his name is McCoy. I just found out in the bathroom, and he ain't married.
I print my name on the blackboard. Mr. McCourt. A girl in the back of the room calls out,
Mister, you got a girlfriend?
They laugh again. I blush again. They nudge each other. The girls say,
isn't he cute?
And I take refuge in your world and you. Open your books. Chapter 1. We'll start at the beginning. A brief history of the United States of America.
Mr. McCoy.
McCourt.
Oh, yeah. We know all about that Columbus and everything. We get that in history class with Mr. Bogard. He'd be mad if you teach history, and he's getting paid to teach it, and that's not your job.
I have to teach what's in the book.
Miss Mudd didn't teach us what's in the book. She didn't give a shit. Excuse me, Mr. McCoy.
McCourt, yeah. And when the bell rings and they rush from the room, Daniela comes to my desk and tells me not to worry. Don't listen to these kids. They're all so stupid. She's taken the commercial course to be a legal secretary, and who knows, she might be a lawyer herself someday. She'll take care of the attendance and everything. She tells me, don't take no shit from nobody, Mr. McCoy. Excuse the language. There are 35 girls in the next class, all dressed in white with buttons down the front from neck to hem. Most have the same hairstyle, the beehive. They ignore me. They set up little boxes on their desks and peer into mirrors. They pluck their eyebrows. They dab at their cheeks with powder puffs. They apply lipstick and pull their lips back between their teeth. They file their nails and blow at the nail dust. I open the Delaney book to call their names, and they look surprised.
Oh, you the substitute? Where's Miss Mudd?
She has retired.
Are you going to be our regular teacher?
Yes. I ask them what shop they're in, what they're studying.
Cosmetology.
What's that?
Beauty culture. And what's your name, teacher?
I point to my name on the board. Mr. McCourt.
Oh, yeah. Yvonne said you was cute.
I let this pass. If I attempt to correct every grammatical error in these classes, I'll never get to economic citizenship. And worse, if I'm asked to explain the rules of grammar, I'm bound to show my ignorance. I will put up with no distractions. I will begin with Chapter 1 from Your World and You, A Brief History of the United States. I flip the pages from Columbus to the Pilgrims to the War of Independence, the War of 1812, the Civil War, and there's a hand and a voice in the back of the room. Yes?
Mr. McCourt, why are you telling us this stuff?
I'm telling you this because you can't understand economic citizenship unless you have a grasp of the history of your country.
Mr. McCourt, this is an English class. I mean, you're the teacher, and you don't even know what class you're teaching.
They pluck their eyebrows, they file their nails, they shake their beehives, they pity me. They tell me my hair is a mess, and it's easy to see I never had a manicure in my life.
Why don't you come up to Beauty Culture Shop and we'll do you?
They smile and nudge each other, and my face is on fire again. And they say, that's cute too.
Ah, gee, look at him. He's shy.
I have to take control. I have to be the teacher. After all, I was once a corporal in the United States Army. I told men what to do, and if they didn't do it, I'd have their ass, because they were in direct defiance of military regulations and subject to court-martial. I would simply tell these girls what to do. Put everything away and open your books.
What books?
Whatever books you have for English.
All we got is this Giants in the Earth, and that's the most boring book in the world.
And the whole class chants,
uh-huh, boring, boring, boring.
They tell me it's about some family from Europe out there on the prairie, and everyone is depressed and talking about suicide, and no one in the class can finish this book because it makes you want to commit suicide yourself. Why can't they read a nice romance where they don't have all these Europe people all gloomy on the prairie? Or why couldn't they watch movies? They could watch James Dean. Oh, God, James Dean, can't believe he's dead. They could watch him and talk about him. Or they could watch James Dean forever. When the beauty culture girls leave, there's homeroom, an 8-minute period. When I have to take care of the clerical work for 33 students from printing shop, they swarm in, all boys, and they're helpful. They tell me what has to be done and not to worry. I'm to take attendance, send a list of absentees to Miss Seasted, collect absentee excuse notes supposedly written by parents and doctors, distribute transportation passes for bus, train, ferry. One boy brings the contents of Miss Mudd's mailbox in the office. There are notes and letters from various officials in and out of the school, notes summoning wayward students for counseling, requests and demands for lists and forms and second and third reminders for everything. Miss Mudd seems to have ignored everything in her mailbox for weeks, and my head feels heavy with the thought of the work she's left me. The boys tell me I don't have to take attendance every day, but once I start, I can't stop. Most are Italian, and taking the attendance is light opera. Adinolfi, Buscaglia, Cacciamani, DeFazio, Esposito, Gagliardo, Micheli. I'm supposed to lead the class in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance and singing the Star-Spangled Banner. I barely know them, but that doesn't matter. The boys stand, place their hands in their hearts, and recite their own version of the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of Staten Island and to one knight stands, one girl under me, invisible to all, with love and kisses for me, only me. When they sing the Star-Spangled Banner, some hum along with, "You ain't nothing but a hound dog." There's a note from the academic chairman requesting I go to his office next period, the third, my prep period, when I'm supposed to plan my lessons. He tells me I should have a lesson plan for every class, and there's a standard form for lesson plans. I should insist all students keep notebooks that are clean and neat. I should make sure that textbooks are covered, points off if they don't. I should check to see that windows are open 6 inches from the top. I should send a student around the room at the end of every period to collect litter. I should stand at the door to greet classes entering and again leaving. I should print clearly on the blackboard the title and aim of every lesson. I should never ask a question requiring a yes or no answer. I shouldn't allow unnecessary noise in the room. I should require all students to stay in their seats unless they raise their hands for the bathroom pass. I should insist on boys removing their hats. I should make it clear that no student is allowed to speak without first raising his hand. I should make sure all students stay till the end of the period, that they're not to be allowed out of the room at the warning bell, which, for my information, rings 5 minutes before the end of the period. If my students are caught in the hallways before the end of the period, I'll have to answer to the principal himself. Any questions? The chairman says there will be midterm exams in 2 weeks, and my teaching should focus on the areas that will be covered in the exams. Students in English should have mastered spelling and vocabulary lists, 100 of each, which they are supposed to have in their notebooks, and if they don't, points off, and be prepared to write essays on 2 novels. Economic citizenship students should be more than halfway through your world anew. The bell rings for the 4th period, my building assignment, the school cafeteria. The chairman tells me that's an easy assignment. I'll be up there with Jake Homer, the teacher the kids fear most. I climb the stairs to the cafeteria, my head throbbing, my mouth dry, and I wish I could sail away with Miss Mudd. Instead, I'm pushed and jostled by students on the staircase and stopped by a teacher who demands to see my pass. He's short and broad, and his bald head sits neckless on his shoulders. He glares at me through thick glasses, and his chin is a challenging jut. I tell him I'm a teacher, and he won't believe me. He wants to see my program card. "Oh," he says, "I'm sorry. You're McCourt. I'm Jake Homer. We'll be in the cafeteria together." I follow him upstairs and along the hallway to the students' cafeteria. There are two lines waiting to be served in the kitchen, a boy's and a girl's. Jake tells me that's one of the big problems keeping the boys and girls separated. He says they're animals at this age, especially the boys, and it's not their fault, it's nature. If he had his way, he'd have the girls in a separate cafeteria altogether. The boys are always strutting and showing off, and if two like the same girl, there's bound to be a fight. He tells me, if there's a fight, don't interfere right away. Let the little bastards go at it and get it out of their systems. It's worse in the warm weather, May, June, when the girls take off their sweaters and the boys go tit crazy. The girls know what they're doing and the boys are like lapdogs panting. Our job is to keep them separated. And if a boy wants to visit the girls' section, he has to come over here for permission. Otherwise, you'll have 200 kids going at it in broad daylight. We also have to patrol the cafeteria and make sure the kids take their trays and garbage back to the kitchen. Make sure they clean the area around their tables. Jake asks if I'd ever been in the army. When I tell him yes, he says, "Bet you didn't know you'd be pulling this kind of shit detail when you decided to become a teacher. Bet you didn't know you'd be a cafeteria guard, a garbage supervisor, a psychologist, a babysitter, eh? Tell you what to think of teachers in this country, that you have to spend hours of your life looking at these kids eating like pigs and telling them clean up afterwards. Doctors and lawyers don't run around telling people clean up. You won't find teachers in Europe stuck with this kind of crap. Over there, a high school teacher's treated like a professor." A boy carrying his tray to the kitchen doesn't notice that an ice cream wrapper has fallen from his tray. On the way back to his table, Jake calls him over. "Kid, pick up that ice cream wrapper." The boy is defiant. "I didn't drop that." "Kid, I didn't ask you that. I said, pick it up."
"I don't have to pick it up. I know my rights."
"Come here, kid. I'll tell you your rights." It's suddenly quiet in the cafeteria. With everyone looking on, Jake grabs the skin over the boy's left shoulder blade and twists it clockwise. "Kid," he says, "you have 5 rights. Number 1, you shut up. Number 2, you do what you're told. And the other 3 don't count." As Jake twists the skin, the boy tries not to grimace, tries to look good, till Jake twists so hard the boy's knees buckle, and he cries, all right, Mr. Homer, all right, I'll pick up the paper." Jake releases him. "Okay, kid. I can see you're a reasonable kid." The boy slouches back to his seat. He's ashamed, and I know he needn't be. When a master in Leamy's National School in Limerick tormented a boy like that, we were always against the master. And I can feel that's how it is here, the way the students, boys and girls, glare at Jake and me. It makes me wonder if I'll ever be as hard as an Irish schoolmaster or as tough as Jake Homer. The psychology teachers at NYU never told us what we should do in such cases, and that's because university professors never have to supervise students in high school cafeterias. And what will happen if Jake is ever absent, and I'm the only teacher here trying to keep 200 students under control? Surely if I tell a girl pick up a piece of paper and she refuses, I can't twist the skin of her shoulder blade till her knees tremble. No, I'll have to wait till I'm old and tough like Jake. Though even he surely wouldn't twist the skin of a girl's shoulder blade. He's more polite with the girls, calls them dear, and would they mind helping keep this place clean? They say, "Yes, Mr. Homer," and he waddles away, smiling. He stands by me near the kitchen and tells me, You gotta come down on the little bastards like a ton of bricks. Then he says to a boy standing before us, Yes, son.
Mr. Homer, I gotta give you back the dollar I owe you.
What was that, son?
Day, I didn't have lunch money last month. You gave me a lend of a buck.
Forget it, son. Get yourself an ice cream.
But Mr. Homer...
Go on, son. Get yourself a treat.
Thanks, Mr. Homer.
Okay, kid.
He tells me,
That's a nice kid. You wouldn't believe what a hard time he has. Still comes to school. His father tortured, nearly killed by a Mussolini gang in Italy. Jesus, you wouldn't believe the hard times they have, these kids' families. And this is the richest country in the world. Count your blessings, McCourt. Mind if I call you Frank?
Not at all, Mr. Homer.
Call me Jake.
Okay, Jake.
It's my lunch hour, and he directs me to the teacher's cafeteria on the top floor. Mr. Cirola sees me and introduces me to teachers at different tables. Mr. Rowntree, printing, Mr. Kriegsman, health aid, Mr. Gordon, machine shop, Miss Gilfillan, art, Mr. Garber, speech, Mr. Bogart, social studies, Mr. Marate, social studies. I take my tray with sandwich and coffee and sit at an empty table, but Mr. Bogart comes over, tells me his name is Bob, and invites me to sit with him and the other teachers. I'd like to stay by myself because I don't know what to say to anyone, and as soon as I open my mouth, they'll say, Oh, you're Irish, and I have to explain how that happened. It's not as bad as being black. You can always change your accent, but you can never change the color of your skin. And it must be a nuisance when you're black and people think they have to talk about black matters just because you're there with that skin. You can change your accent, and people will stop telling you where their parents came from in Ireland. But there's no escape when you're black. But I can't say no to Mr. Bogart after he went to all the trouble of coming to my table. And when I'm settled with my coffee and sandwich, the teachers introduce themselves again with first names. Jack Kriegsman says, Your first day, eh? You sure you want to do this? Some teachers laugh and shake their heads as if to say they're sorry they ever got into this. Bob Bogart doesn't laugh. He leans across the table and says, If there's any profession more important than teaching, I'd like to know what it is. No one seems to know what to say after that till Stanley Garber asks me what subject I teach. English? Well, not exactly. They have me teaching three classes of economic citizenship. And Miss Gilfinan says, Oh, you're Irish. It's so nice to hear the brogue here. She tells me her ancestry and wants to know where I came from, when I came, will I ever go back, and why are the Catholics and Protestants always fighting in the old country. Jack Kriegsman says they're worse than the Jews and the Arabs, and Stanley Garber disagrees. Stanley says at least the Irish on both sides have one thing in common, Christianity, and the Jews and the Arabs are as different as day and night. Jack says, bullshit, and Stanley comes back with a sarcastic, oh, that's an intelligent comment. When the bell rings, Bob Bogart and Stanley Garber walk me downstairs, and Bob tells me he knows the situation in Miss Mudd's classes, that the kids are wild after weeks where there was no teaching, and if I need help to let him know. I tell him I do need help. I'd like to know what the hell I'm supposed to do with economic citizenship classes facing midterm exams in 2 weeks who haven't even looked at the book. How am I supposed to give grades and report cards based on nothing? Stanley says, Don't worry. A lot of the report card grades in this school are based on nothing anyway. There are kids here reading on a third grade level, and it's not your fault. They should be in elementary school, but they can't be kept there because they're 6 feet tall, too big for the furniture, and trouble for the teachers. You'll see. He and Bob Bogart look at my program and shake their heads. 3 classes at the end of the day. That's the worst possible program you can get. An impossible one for a new teacher. The kids have had their lunch, and they're all charged up with protein and sugar, and they want to be outside horsing around. Sex. That's all it is, says Stanley. Sex, sex, sex. But that's what happens when you arrive in the middle of the term and take over for the Miss Muds of the world. Good luck, says Stanley. Let me know if I can help, says Bob. I grapple with the protein and the sugar and the sex and periods 6, 7, and 8, but I'm silenced by a hail of questions and objections.
Where's Miss Mudd? She dead? She eloped? Ha, ha, ha. You our new teacher? You gonna be with us forever and ever? You got a girlfriend, teacher? No, we don't have no world in you. Dumb book. Why can't we talk about movies? I had a teacher in 5th grade talked about movies all the time and they fired her. She was a great teacher. Teacher, don't forget to take the attendance. Miss Mudd always took the attendance.
Miss Mudd didn't have to take the attendance because in every class there's a monitor to do it. The monitor is usually a shy girl with a neat notebook and good handwriting. For taking the attendance, she gets service credits, and that impresses employers when she goes looking for a job in Manhattan. The sophomore English students break into cheers at the news that Miss Mudd is gone forever. She was mean. She tried to make them read that boring book, Giants in the Earth, and she said when they were finished with that, they'd have to read Silas Marner. And Louis by the window, who reads lots of books, told everyone it's a book about a dirty old man in England and a little girl, and that's the kind of book we shouldn't be reading in America. Miss Mudd said they'd have to read Silas Marner because there was a midterm exam coming up, and they'd have to write an essay comparing it with Giants in the Earth. And the students in 8th period, sophomore English, would like to know, where does she get off thinking you can compare a book about gloomy people on a prairie with a book about a dirty old man in England? They cheer again. They tell me, we don't want to read no dumb books. You mean you don't want to read any dumb books?
What?
Oh, nothing. The warning bell rings and they gather up their coats and bags to pile out the door. I have to shout, sit down. That's the warning bell. They look surprised.
What's up, teacher?
You're not supposed to leave at the warning bell.
Miss Mudd let us leave.
I'm not Miss Mudd.
Miss Mudd was nice. She let us leave. Why are you so mean?
They're out the door and I can't stop them. Mr. Cirola is in the hallway to tell me my students are not supposed to leave at the warning bell.
I know, Mr. Cirola. I couldn't stop them.
Well, Mr. McCourt, a little more discipline tomorrow, eh?
Yes, Mr. Cirola.
Is this man serious, or is he pulling my leg?
Chapter 37. Old Italian men patrol the Staten Island ferry for shoeshine customers. I've had a hard night and a harder day, and is there any reason why I shouldn't spend a dollar plus a quarter tip on a shoeshine, even if this old Italian shakes his head and tells me in his broken English that I should buy a new pair of shoes from his brother, who sells them on Delancey Street, and would give me a good price if I mention Alfonso on the ferry. When he finishes, he shakes his head and says he'll charge me only 50 cents because these are the worst shoes he's seen in years, a bum shoes, shoes you wouldn't put in a dead man, and I should go to Delancey Street and don't forget to tell his brother who sent me. I tell him how I don't have the money for a new pair. I just started a new job, and he says, all right, give me a dollar. He says, you teacher, right? And I say, how do you know? Teachers always have the lousy shoes. I give him the dollar and the tip, and he walks away shaking his head and calling, shine, shine. It's a bright March day, and pleasant to sit on the deck outside to watch tourists, excited with their cameras, over the Statue of Liberty, the long finger of the Hudson River ahead, the Manhattan skyline drifting toward us. The water is alive with little choppy white waves, and there's a warm spring touch in the breeze blowing up the narrows. Oh, it's good. And I'd like to stand up there on the bridge, steering this old ferry, back and forth, through the tugs and scows and freighters and liners that heave the harbor into swells that plash against the ferry car deck. That would be a pleasant life, easier than facing dozens of high school kids every day with their secret little nudges, winks, and laughs
their complaints and objections, or the way they have of ignoring me as if I were a piece of furniture. A memory floats into my head from a morning at NYU, a face saying, "Aren't we being a little paranoid?" Paranoid. I looked it up. If I'm standing before a class, and one kid whispers something to another, and they laugh, will I think they're laughing at me? Will they sit in the cafeteria imitating my accent and joking about my red eyes? I know they will, because we did the same thing in Limes National School. And if I'm going to worry about it, I might as well spend my life in the loan department of the manufacturer's trust company. Is this what I'll do the rest of my life? Take the subway, then the ferry to Staten Island, climb the hill to McKee Vocational and Technical High School, punch in at the time clock, extract a bulge of paper from my mailbox, tell my students class after class, day after day, "Sit down, please, open your notebooks, take out your pens, you don't have paper, here's paper, you don't have a pen, borrow one, copy the notes on the board, you can't see from there, Joy, would you change seats with Brian, come on, Joy, don't be such a..." "No, Joy, I didn't call you a jerk. I just asked you to change seats with Brian, who needs glasses." "You don't need glasses, Brian." "Well, why do you have to move?" "Never mind, Joy, just move, will you?" "Freddie, put that sandwich away. This isn't the lunchroom." "I don't care if you're hungry." "No, you can't go to the bathroom to eat your sandwich. You're not supposed to be eating sandwiches in the toilet." "What is it, Maria? You're sick. You have to see the nurse." "Okay, here's the pass. Diane, would you take Maria to the nurse's office and let me know what the nurse says?" "No, I know they won't tell you what's wrong with her. I just want to know if she'll be coming back to class." "What is it, Albert? You're sick too?" "No, you're not, Albert. You just sit there and do your work. You gotta see the nurse, Albert. You're really sick. You got diarrhea." "Well, here's the pass to the boys' room, and don't stay there all period. The rest of you, finish copying the notes on the board. There will be a test. You know that, don't you? There will be a test." "What's that, Sebastian? Your pen ran out of ink." "Well, why didn't you say something?" "Yes, you're saying it now, but you could have said it 10 minutes ago. Oh, you didn't want to interrupt all these sick people." "That's nice of you, Sebastian. Does anyone have a pen to loan Sebastian?" "Oh, come on. What's that, Joy? Sebastian is a what? A what?" "You shouldn't say things like that, Joy. Sebastian, sit down. No fighting in the classroom. What's that, Anne? You gotta go." "Go where, Anne?" "Oh, you got your period." "You're right, Joy. She doesn't have to tell the whole world." "Yes, Daniela, you want to take Anne to the bathroom. Why?" "Oh, she doesn't speak good English, so what does that have to do with her having her?" "What's that, Joy?" "You don't think girls should talk like that?" "Easy, Daniela, easy. You don't have to be insulting." "What's that, Joy?" "You're religious and people shouldn't talk like that." "Okay, easy, Daniela. I know you're defending Anne, who needs to go to the toilet, the bathroom, so go, take her there. And the rest of you, copy the notes on the board." "Oh, you can't see either? You want to move up?" "Okay, move up. Here's an empty seat, but where's your notebook?" "You left it on the bus." "All right, you need paper, here's paper. You need a pen, here's a pen. You need to go to the bathroom." "Well, go to the bathroom, eat a sandwich, hang out with your friends. Jesus!" "Mr. McCoy?" "McCourt, you shouldn't swear like that. You shouldn't say God's name like that." They say, "Oh, Mr. McCourt, you should take off tomorrow. Paddy's Day. Gee, you're Irish. You should go to the parade." If I took off and stayed in bed all day, they'd be just as pleased. Substitutes for absent teachers rarely bother with attendance, and students simply cut class. "Ah, come on, Mr. McCourt, you need a holiday with your Irish friends. I mean, you wouldn't come to school if you was in Ireland, would you?" They groan when I appear on the day. "Ah, shit, man, excuse the language, what kind of Irishman are you? Hey, teacher, maybe you'll go out tonight with all the Irish, maybe you won't be in tomorrow." "I'll be here tomorrow." They bring me green things, a potato sprayed, a green bagel, a bottle of Heineken's because it's green, a head of cabbage with holes for eyes, nose, mouth, wearing a little green leprechaun cap made in the art room. The cabbage is Kevin and has a girlfriend, an eggplant named Maureen. There's a greeting card, 2 feet by 2, wishing me happy St. Patty's Day, with a collage of green paper things, shamrocks, shillelaghs, whiskey bottles, a drawing of a green corned beef, St. Patrick holding a glass of green beer instead of a crozier and saying, "Faith and begorra, it's a great day for the Irish." A drawing of me with a balloon saying, "Kiss me, I'm Irish." The card is signed by dozens of students from my 5 classes and decorated with happy faces shaped like shamrocks. The classes are noisy.
"Hey, Mr. McCaw, how come you ain't wearing green?" "Because he don't have to, stupid, he's Irish." "Mr. McCaw, why don't you go to the parade?" "Because he just started this job. Christ sakes, he's only here a week."
Mr. Cirola opens the door. "Is everything all right, Mr. McCourt?"
"Oh, yes."
He comes to my desk, looks at the card, smiles.
"They must like you, eh?
And you've been here how long? A week?"
"Almost."
"Well, this is very nice. But see if you can get them back to work." He goes towards the door and he's followed by, "Happy St. Paddy's Day, Mr. Cirola." But he leaves without turning around. When someone at the back of the room says, "Mr. Cirola is a miserable guinea," there's a scuffle that ends only when I threaten them with a test on your world and you. Then someone says, "Cirola ain't no Italian, he's Finnish."
"Finnish? What's Finnish?"
"Finland, stupid, where it's dark all the time."
"He don't look Finnish."
"So, shithead, what does Finnish look like?"
"I don't know, but he don't look it. He could be Sicilian."
"He's not Sicilian, he's Finnish, and I'm laying a dollar bet. Anyone want a bet?" No one wants to challenge the bet, and I tell them, "All right, open your notebooks." They're indignant.
"Open our notebooks? Paddy's Day? And you're telling us, open our notebooks, after we got you the card and everything?"
"I know. Thank you for the card. But this is a regular school day. There will be tests, and we have to cover your world and you." There's groaning around the room, and the green is gone out of the day.
"Oh, Mr. McCourt, if you only knew how we hate that book. Oh, Mr. McCourt, can't you tell us about Ireland or something? Mr. McCourt, tell us about your girlfriend. You must have a nice girlfriend. You're real cute. My mother's divorced. She'd like to meet you. Mr. McCourt, I got a sister your age. She got a big job in a bank. She likes all that old music, Bing Crosby and all. Mr. McCourt, I seen this Irish movie, The Quiet Man, on TV, and John Wayne was beating up his wife. What's her name? And is that what they do in Ireland, beat up their wives?"
"They would do anything to avoid your world and you."
"Mr. McCourt, did you keep pigs in your kitchen?"
"We didn't have a kitchen."
"Yeah, but if you didn't have a kitchen, how could you cook?"
"We had a fireplace where we boiled water for tea and we ate bread." They couldn't believe we had no electricity and wanted to know how we kept food refrigerated. The one who asked about pigs in the kitchen said, "Everyone has a refrigerator," till another boy told him he was wrong, that his mother grew up in Sicily and didn't have a refrigerator, and if the pigs in the kitchen boy didn't believe him, they'd meet in a dark alley after school, and only one of them would come out. Some girls in the class told them, "Cool it," and one said she felt so sorry for me growing up like that, that if she could go back in time, she'd take me home and let me take a nice bath as long as I liked, and then I could eat everything in the refrigerator, everything. The girls nodded, and the boys were quiet, and I was glad the bell rang so that I could escape to the teacher's toilet with my strange emotions. I am learning the art of the high school students' delaying tactics, how they seize on any occasion to avoid the work of the day. They flatter and cajole and hold their hands over their hearts, declaring they're desperate to hear all about Ireland and the Irish. They would have asked days ago, but they delayed till St. Patrick's Day, knowing I'd want to celebrate my heritage and religion and everything. And would I tell them about Irish music? And is it true Ireland is green all the time, and the girls have those cute little upturned noses, and the men drink, drink, drink? Is it true, Mr. McCourt? There are muttered threats and promises around the room. "I ain't staying in school today. I'm going to the parade in the city. All the Catholic schools have the day off. I'm Catholic.
Why shouldn't I have the day off? Fuck this. End of this period, you'll see my ass in the ferry. You come enjoy? Nah, my mother would kill me. I'm not Irish. So what? I'm not Irish neither. Irish only want Irish in that parade. Bullshit. They got Negroes in the parade. And if they got Negroes, why should I be sitting here and I'm Italian Catholic? They won't like it. I don't care. Irish wouldn't even be here except Columbus discovered this country and he was Italian. My uncle said he was Jewish. I'll kiss my ass, Joy. There's a ripple of excitement in the room and calls for fight, fight, hit him, Joy, hit him. Because a fight is another way of passing the time and keeping the teacher from the lesson. It's time for teacher intervention. All right, all right, open your notebooks. And there are cries of pain. Notebooks, notebooks. Mr. McCall, why are you doing this to us? And we don't want to know your world on you on Paddy's Day. My mother's mother was Irish, and we should have respect. Why can't you tell us about school in Ireland? Why? All right. I'm a new teacher, and I've lost the first battle, and it's all the fault of St. Patrick. I tell this class, and all my classes the rest of the day, about school in Ireland, about the masters with their sticks, straps, canes, how we had to memorize everything and recite, how the masters would kill us if we ever tried to fight in their classrooms, how we were not allowed to ask questions nor have discussions, how we left school at 14 and became messenger boys or unemployed. I tell them about Ireland because I have no choice. My students have seized the day and there's nothing I can do about it. I could threaten them with your world and you and Silas Marner and satisfy myself that I was in control, that I was teaching. But I know there would be a flurry of requests for passes for the toilets, the nurse, the guidance counselor, and can I have the pass to call my aunt who's dying of cancer in Manhattan? If I insisted on hewing to the curriculum today, I'd be talking to myself, and my instincts tell me one group of experienced students in an American classroom can break one inexperienced teacher. How about high school, Mr. McCourt? I didn't go. Sebastian says, yeah, it shows. And I promise myself, I'll get you later, you little bastard. They tell him, shut up, Sebastian. Mr. McCourt, didn't they have no high school in Ireland? They had dozens of high schools, but kids from my school were not encouraged to go. Man, I'd like to live in a country where you didn't have to go to high school. In the teacher's cafeteria, there are two schools of thought. The old-timers tell me, you're young, you're new, but don't let these damn kids ride all over you. Let them know who's boss in the classroom, and remember, you are the boss. Control is the big thing in teaching. No control and you can't teach. You have the power to pass and fail, and they know goddamn well if they fail, there's no place for them in this society. They'll be sweeping the streets and washing the dishes, and it'll be their own fault, the little bastards. Just don't take shit. You're the boss. The man with the red pen. Most of the old-timers survived the Second World War. They won't talk about it except to hint at bad times at Monte Cassino, the Battle of the Bulge, Japanese prisoner of war camps, riding a tank into a German town and searching for your mother's family. You see all this, and you're not going to take shit from these kids. You fought so they could sit on their asses in school every day and get the school lunch they whine about all the time, and that's more than your own father and mother ever had. Younger teachers are not so sure. They've taken courses in educational psychology and the philosophy of education. They've read John Dewey, and they tell me, these children are human beings and we have to meet their felt needs. I don't know what a felt need is, and I don't ask for fear of exposing my ignorance. The younger teachers shake their heads over the older ones. They tell me, the war is over, these children are not the enemy, they're our children, for God's sakes. An older teacher says, felt needs my ass. Jump from a plane into a field full of krauts, and you know what a felt need is. And John Dewey can kiss my ass, too.
just like the rest of these goddamn college professors, bullshitting about teaching in high schools. And they wouldn't know a high school kid if he walked up and pissed on their leg. Stanley Garber says, "That's right. Every day we put on our armor and go into battle." Everyone laughs because Stanley has the easiest job in the school. Speech teacher. No paperwork. No books. What the hell would he know about going into battle? He sits behind his desk and asks his small classes what they'd like to talk about today, and all he has to do is correct their pronunciation. He tells me it's really too late to help them by the time they get to high school. This is not My Fair Lady, and he's not Professor Henry Higgins. On days when he's not in the mood or they don't want to talk, he tells them get lost, and he comes to the cafeteria to discuss the terrible state of American education. Mr. Cirola smiles at Stanley through his cigarette smoke. "So, Mr. Garber," he says, "how does it feel to be retired?" Stanley smiles back. "You should know, Mr. Cirola. You've been retired for years." We'd all like to laugh, but you never know with principals. When I tell my students bring their books to class, they claim, "Miss Mudd never gave us no books." Economic citizenship classes say, "We don't know nothing about your world and you." And English classes say, "They never saw Giants in the Earth or Silas Marner." The chairman of the academic department says, "Of course they got books. And when they got them, they had to fill out book receipts. Look in Miss Mudd's desk, excuse me, your desk, and you'll find them." There are no book receipts in the desk. There are travel brochures, crossword puzzle books, an assortment of forms, directives, letters Miss Mudd wrote and never sent. A few letters to her from former students, a life of Bach in German, a life of Balzac in French. And there are innocent looks around the room when I say, "Didn't Miss Mudd hand out books? And didn't you fill in book receipts?" They look at one another and shake their heads. "Did you get a book?" "I don't remember getting a book. Miss Mudd, she never did nothing." I know they're lying, because in each class there are two or three with books. And I know they got their books in the normal way. Teacher distributes them. Teacher gets book receipts. I don't want to embarrass the students who have the books by asking them how they came by them. I can't ask them to make liars of their classmates. The chairman stops me in the hallway. "Well, how about those books?" And when I tell him how I can't embarrass the students who have the books, he says, "Bullshit," and storms into my class next period. "All right, the ones who have books, raise your hands." There's one hand. "All right, where did you get that book?"
I got it, from Miss Mudd."
"And you signed the receipt?"
Yeah."
"What's your name?"
"Julio."
"And when you got that book, didn't the rest of the class get books too?" I feel my heart beating hard, and I'm angry that even if I'm a new teacher, this is my class, and no one should barge in here and embarrass one of my students. And Christ, I have to say something. I have to come between this boy and this chairman. I tell the chairman, "I already asked Julio about that. He was absent and got the book from Miss Mudd at the end of the day."
"Oh, yeah? Is that right, Julio?"
"Yeah. And the rest of you, when did you get your books?" There's silence. They know I lied, and Julio knows I lied, and the chairman surely suspects me of lying, but he doesn't know what to do. He says, "We'll get to the bottom of this," and leaves. The word goes from class to class, and next day there's a book on every desk. "Your World and You," and Silas Marner. And when the chairman returns with Mr. Cirola, he doesn't know what to say. Mr. Cirola gives his little smile. "So, Mr. McCourt, we're back in business, huh?" There may be books on every desk this one day when students and teachers present the united front to the outsiders, the chairman, the principal. But once they leave, the honeymoon ends, and there's a chorus of complaints about these books, how boring they are, how heavy, and why do they have to bring them to school every day? The English students say, "Oh,
Silas Marner's a small book, but if they have to carry giants in the earth, you need a big breakfast. It's such a big book, and it's so boring. Will they have to carry it every day? Why can't they leave it in the classroom closet?
If you leave it in the closet, how are you going to read it?
Why can't we read it in class? All the other teachers tell their classes, okay, Henry, you read page 19. Okay, Nancy, you read page 20. And that's how they finish the book. And when they're reading, we can put our heads down and take a nap. Ha, ha, ha. Just kidding, Mr. McCord.
Chapter 38.
In Manhattan, my brother Malachy is running a bar called Malachy's with two partners. He acts with the Irish Players, appears on radio and television, and gets his name into the newspapers. That brings me fame at McKee Vocational and Technical High School. Now my students know my name, and I'm not Mr. McCoy anymore. Hey, Mr. McCoy, I seen your brother on TV. He's a crazy guy. Mr. McCord, my mother seen your brother on TV. Mr. McCord, how come you're not on TV? How come you're just a teacher? Mr. McCord, you got an Irish accent. Why can't you be funny like your brother? Mr. McCord, you could be on TV. You could be in a love story with Miss Mudd, holding her hands in a ship and kissing her old wrinkly face.
Teachers who venture into the city, Manhattan, tell me they see Malachy in plays.
Oh, he's funny, your brother. We said hello to him after the play and told him we'd teach with you, and he was very nice, but boy, does he like to drink.
My brother Michael is out of the Air Force and working behind the bar with Malachy. If people want to buy my brothers a drink, who are they to say no? It's cheers, bottoms up, schlante, and scold. When the bar closes, they don't have to go home. There are after-hours joints where they can drink and trade stories with police inspectors and gracious madams from the finest brothels on the Upper East Side. They can breakfast at Rubens on Central Park South, where there are always celebrities to keep your neck swiveling. Malachy was famous for his come in, girls, and to hell with the old farts up and down Third Avenue. The old bar owners looked with suspicion on a woman alone. She was up to no good, and there was no place at the bar for her. Put her over there in a dark corner, and give her no more than two drinks. And, if there's a hint of a man going near her, out she goes on the sidewalk, and that's that. When Malachy's bar opened, the word spread that girls from the Barbizon women's residence were actually sitting up in his bar stools. And soon the men flocked in from P.J. Clark's, Toots Shores, El Morocco, to be trailed by a snoop of gossip columnists, eager to report celebrity sightings and Malachy's latest wild doings. There were playboys and their ladies, pioneers of the jet set. There were heirs to fortune so old and deep, their tendrils curled in the dark depths of South African diamond mines. Malachy and Michael were invited to parties in Manhattan apartments so vast that guests emerged days later from forgotten rooms. There were skinny-dipping parties in the Hamptons and parties in Connecticut where rich men rode the rich women who rode the thoroughbred horses. President Eisenhower takes time off from his golf to sign an occasional bill and to warn us of the industrial-military complex, and Richard Nixon watches and waits while Malachy and Michael pour the drinks and keep everyone laughing and demanding more. More drinks, Malachy. More stories, Michael. You two are a riot. Meanwhile, my mother, Angela McCord, drinks tea in her comfortable kitchen in Limerick. Hears stories from visitors about the great times in New York. Sees newspaper clippings about Malachy on the Jack Parr show. And she has nothing else to do but drink that tea. Keep the house and herself nice and warm. Look after Alfie, now that he's out of school and ready for a job, whatever that may be. Or wouldn't it be lovely if she and Alfie could take a little trip to New York, because she hasn't been there in ages and her sons, Frank, Michael, Malachy, are there and doing so well? My cold water flat on Downing Street is uncomfortable. And there's nothing I can do about it because of my small teacher's salary
and the few dollars I send my mother till my brother Alfie gets a job. When I moved in, I bought kerosene for my cast iron stove from the little Italian hunchback on Bleecker Street. He said, "You only need a little in the stove." But I must have put in too much because the stove turned into a great red living thing in my kitchen. And since I didn't know how to turn it down or off, I fled the flat and went to the White Horse Tavern where I sat all afternoon in a terrible state of nerves, waiting for the boom of the explosion and the wailing and honking of fire engines. I would have to decide then if I should go back to the smoking remains of 46 Downing Street, with charred bodies being brought out, and face fire inspectors and police, or if I should call Alberta in Brooklyn, tell her my building was in ashes, my belongings all gone, and could she see her way to putting me up for a few days till I could find another cold water flat. There was no explosion, no fire, and I felt so relieved I thought I deserved a bath, time in the tub, a little peace, ease, and comfort, as my mother would say. It's all right to loll in a tub in a cold water flat, but there's a problem with the head. The flat is so cold that if you stay in the tub long enough, your head begins to freeze and you don't know what to do with it. If you slip under the water, head and all, you suffer when you emerge and the hot water on your head freezes, and then you're shivering and sneezing from the chin up. And you can't read in comfort in a tub in a cold water flat. The body submerged in the hot water might grow pink and wrinkled from the heat, but the hands holding the book turn purple from the cold. If it's a small book, you can alternate the hands, holding the book with one hand while the other is in warm water. This could be a solution to the reading problem, except that the hand that was in the water is now wet and threatening to make the book soggy, and you can't reach for the towel every few minutes because you want that towel to be warm and dry at the end of your time in the tub. I thought I could solve the head problem by wearing a knitted skier's cap, and the hand problem with a pair of cheap gloves, but then I worried that if I ever died of a heart attack, the ambulance people would wonder what I was doing wearing cap and gloves in the tub. And of course they'd slip this discovery to the Daily News, and I'd be the laughingstock of McKee Vocational and Technical High School and the patrons of various bars. I bought the cap and gloves anyway. And on the day of no explosion, I filled the tub with hot water. I decided to be good to myself, forget the reading and slide under the water as often as I liked to keep the head from freezing. I turned on the radio to music suitable for a man who had survived a nerve-wracking afternoon with a dangerous stove, plugged in my electric blanket and draped it across a chair beside the tub so that I could step out, dry myself quickly with the pink towel Alberta had given me, wrap myself in the electric blanket, put on my cap and gloves, and I lay on the bed, cozy and warm, watched the snow beat against my window, thank God the stove had cooled by itself, and read myself to sleep with Anna Karenina. The tenant under me is Bradford Rush, who moved into the flat when I told him about it on the midnight shift at the Manufacturers Trust Company. If anyone at the bank called him Brad, he snapped at them, "Bradford, Bradford, my name is Bradford," so mean that no one ever wanted to talk to him. And when we went out for breakfast or lunch or whatever we called it at 3 a.m., he was never invited to join us. Then one of the women who was leaving to get married invited him to have a drink with us, and he told us after three drinks he was from Colorado, a graduate of Yale College and living in New York to get over the suicide of his mother, who screamed for 6 months with bone cancer. The woman leaving to get married burst into tears over the story, and we wondered why the hell Bradford had to hang such a cloud over our small party. That's what I asked him on the train to Downing Street that night, but all I got was a little smile, and I wondered if he was right in the head. I wonder why he did clerical work in a bank when he had an Ivy League degree and could have been on Wall Street with his own kind. Later, I wonder why he didn't just say no to me in my time of crisis, the bitter February day my electricity was turned off for non-payment. I came home to give myself the peace, ease, and comfort of a hot bath in the kitchen tub. I draped the electric blanket over the chair. I turned on the radio. There was no sound.
There was no warmth in the blanket, no light from the lamp. The water was steaming into the tub, and I was naked. Now I had to put on cap, gloves, and socks, wrap myself in an electric blanket with no heat, and curse the company that turned off my electricity. It was still daylight, but I knew I couldn't stay in that condition. Bradford. Surely he wouldn't mind doing me a little favor. I knocked on his door, and he opened it with his usual grimness. Yes? Bradford, I have a bit of a crisis upstairs. Why are you wrapped up in that electric blanket? That's what I came to talk to you about. They cut off my electricity, and I have no heat but this blanket. And I wondered if I dropped a long extension cord out of my window, you might take it and plug it in, and I'd have electricity till I can pay my bill, which I promise you will be very soon. I could tell he didn't want to do it, but he gave a little nod and pulled in my extension cord when I dropped it. I knocked on the floor 3 times, hoping he'd understand that I was saying thank you, but there was no response. And whenever I saw him on the stairs, he barely acknowledged me, and I knew he was brooding on the extension cord. The electrical shop teacher at McKee told me an arrangement like this would cost a few measly pennies a day, and couldn't understand why anyone would resent it. He said I could offer the cheap bastard a few dollars for the great inconvenience of having a cord plugged into an outlet, but people like that were so miserable anyway, it wasn't the money. It was the way they had of not being able to say no, so that the no turned into acid in their guts and destroyed their lives. I thought the electrical shop teacher was exaggerating, till I noticed Bradford was becoming more and more hostile. He used to smile a little, or nod, or grunt something. Now he passes me without a word, and I'm worried because I still don't have the money for the bill, and I don't know how long our arrangement will last. Makes me so nervous, I always turn on the radio to make sure I can take a bath and have the blanket warming up. My cord stayed in his outlet for 2 months, and then on a bitter night at the end of April, there was an act of treachery. I turned on the radio, laid my electric blanket on a chair to warm up, put towel cap and gloves on the blanket so that they'd be warm too, filled the tub, soaped myself, and lay back listening to the symphony fantastique of Hector Berlioz. And in the middle of the second movement, when I'm ready to float out of the tub with the excitement, everything stops, the radio is off, the light is out, and I know the blanket will grow cold on the back of the chair. And I knew what he did, this Bradford, pull the cord on a man in a tub of hot water in a cold water flat. I knew I could never have done that to him or anyone else. I might do it to someone with central heating, but never to a fellow cold water flat tenant. Never. I leaned over the side of the tub and knocked on the floor, hoping he might have made a mistake, that he'd have the decency to plug me back in, but no, not a sound from him, and no radio, no light. The water was still warm, so I could lie there a while, thinking about the villainy of the human race, how a man with a degree from Yale College could deliberately take hold of an electric cord and yank it from the outlet, leaving me to freeze to death upstairs. One act of treachery like that is enough to make you give up hope and think of revenge. No, it wasn't revenge I wanted. It was electricity. And I have to find another way to bring Bradford to his senses. There was a spoon, and there was a long piece of string. And if I tied string to spoon, I could open the window and dangle spoon so that it tapped against Bradford's window, and he might understand that I was up there at the other end of the string, tapping, tapping for the gift of electricity. He might be annoyed and ignore my spoon, but I remember how he once told me that a dripping faucet was enough to keep him awake all night, and if necessary, I'd tap on his window with my spoon till he could stand it no longer. He could have climbed the stairs and banged on my door and told me stop, but I knew he could never be that direct, and I knew I had him cornered. I felt sorry for him, and the way his mother screamed for 6 months with bone cancer, and I tried to make all this up to him someday, but this was a crisis, and I needed my radio, my light, my electric blanket, or I'd have to call Alberta for a night's lodgings
and if she asked me why, I could never tell her about Bradford plugging me in all those weeks. She'd get into a state of righteous indignation, the New England kind, and tell me I should be paying my bills and not tapping on people's windows with spoons on bitter nights, especially the windows of people whose mothers had died screaming of bone cancer. Then I'd tell her there was no connection between my spoon and Bradford's dead mother, and that would lead to more disagreement and a fight, and I'd have to storm out back to my flat in the cold and the dark. It was a Friday night, his night off from the bank, and I knew he couldn't escape by going to work. I imagined him downstairs with a cord in his hand, trying to decide what to do with the spoon at his window. He could have gone out, but where would he go? Who would want to have a beer with him in a bar and listen to how his mother died screaming? On top of that, he'd probably tell the world someone upstairs was tormenting him with a spoon, and anyone in a bar with a beer would move away from him. I tapped on and off for a few hours, and suddenly there was light and music from the radio. Symphony Fantastique was long over, and that irritated me, but I turned the dial up on the electric blanket, put on cap and gloves, and got back into bed with Anna Karenina, which I couldn't read because of the darkness in my head over Bradford and his poor mother in Colorado. If my mother were dying of bone cancer in Limerick, and someone upstairs tormented me with a spoon at my window, I'd go up and kill him. I felt so guilty now, I thought of knocking on Bradford's door and telling him, "I'm sorry over the spoon and your poor mother, and you can pull the plug." But I was so warm and cozy in the bed, I fell asleep. The following week, I met him loading his things into a van. I asked if I could help, and all he said was, "Prick." He moved out, but he left me plugged in, and I had weeks of electricity till I blew the cord with an electric heater and had to go to Beneficial Finance Company for a loan to pay my electricity bills so that I wouldn't freeze to death.